You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
If everybody had a nose across the USA, then everybody'd be served like California. You see them wearing their baggies, Warachi sandals too, a bushy, bushy blonde hairdo.
All right, the what you're going to hear right now is General Neller and General John being interviewed by John Allen, right? And so I'm looking forward to it. I haven't heard the whole thing. I've seen little excerpts of it, and I'm excited to hear it. So without further ado, two four-star generals sitting down and talking. And I haven't even seen this like being ballyhooed on the internet. So anyway. Here you have it, John Allen, General United States Marine Corps, and Robert Neller, Commandant of the Marine Corps, General, talking in under the broad heading of a 21st Century Strategic Forum, National Defense Strategy and Global Impact, which is something that General Allen is all about. Grand strategy. To be honest with you, what China's doing. Economic power. Linked to military power, linked to diplomacy, all on one line, all for the good in terms of Western democracies, you know, things like freedom of navigation, stuff like that around the world. So here you have it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today. And I want to thank our federal executive fellows from across the think tanks of Washington and elsewhere for joining us and being here today. This is an important gathering. It's always an important opportunity for us to address some of the key issues that are motivating the decision-making in Washington, and in this case, the key issues that are constantly being dealt with by our military services, our joint force, and our senior military leadership. In that context, we're really honored today to have with us the 37th Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Robert Neller. I've known General Neller I think since we were captains, maybe even earlier than that. And he is known throughout the Corps, and has been known more broadly than the Corps, obviously, as one of our great operational commanders. And he has been at the center of so much of the operational challenge that we have faced as a nation for so many years. But beyond being a great operator and being respected for his operational credentials, he's also a great thinker. Not just a great thinker in being a problem solver of those problems from moment to moment, but also a visionary thinker and helping not just the Corps, but our services in general in the country by extension to come to grips with the challenges we face today and the challenges we will face in the future. Let me just take a second, though, to make a point that I want to make. Beyond the fact that our careers crossed on many occasions over the years, I had the occasion in 2006, 2007, for our careers to cross in a very particular place at a very particular time. General Neller was commanding the ground combat element of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force in a place called the Al Anbar province in Iraq. And for those of you who know the history of that war, the Al Anbar province in 2006 and 2007 was the most dangerous, most violent place in the entire Iraq war. And that's saying a lot because our Army and Marine Corps brothers and sisters fought some pretty tough battles all across that country. But in the Al Anbar province in 2006, I will simply tell you that it was uncertain how this was going to go. And in many places around the country, and in some newspapers, they had written off the Al Anbar province. Well, I had the chance to watch this general officer, young brigadier, who would become a major general in that war, through his personal courage, his understanding of the enemy, his capacity to wield our forces, the advice he gave to his commander, the great Rick Zillmer, another great Marine, the activities of those forces, his forces, in the Al Anbar province in 2006 turned the war around. It certainly turned the war around in Al Anbar, the result of his efforts and many of the great Marines and soldiers who fought in that province was to defeat Al-Qaeda, and in so doing set the conditions for the theater commander, Dave Petraeus, to see that what the Marines and the soldiers were doing in Al Anbar was going to work more broadly, and the change and the surge ultimately turned the war around in its entirety. I've always taken the opportunity when I'm with this friend and this great military leader to take a moment to point that out, because I want history to reflect that it was on the broad shoulders of the Marines and the soldiers of Al Anbar in 2006, and with the leadership of an individual like Bob Neller, we turned around an entire war that was going south on us. And so, General Neller, Commandant, it's great to have you here today, sir.
Thanks, John.
We have some questions, if I could ask. We'll go for about 20 or so minutes on the stage, and then we'll come out to you for about 30 minutes, and we'll wrap it up sharply at 1300. So, General, we have seen that the challenge of the adoption of the new national defense strategy has created challenges. And as is always the case, there is an equilibrium that we seek between strategy and capability. And that equilibrium is a function of a number of things: the threats that we envisage, the threats that we face, but also the resources that can procure the forces ultimately to match the strategy. Could you take a moment with us, please, sir, and tell us what are the threats that we currently face today, and how does that match up with the strategy, and how are you seeing the resources coming to the Corps in order to fulfill your obligations as the Commandant under this strategy, please?
Well, the strategy, I think, points out pretty clearly who potential adversaries are. Now, if you define a threat as someone who has capability and intent, a number of the nations or organizations that are written about in that strategy, you'd have to say, do they have capability and do they have intent? Most of them have capability. I'd say the violent extremist organizations have a lot of intent. I'm not so sure how much capability they have, but they're still dangerous because they have intent. The others, you read what I read in open press about the intent or the actions of some of those potential adversaries. Their capability is significant. It's growing. So we have to be wary of that. The thing the strategy does, I think, General Allen, is it focuses the naval force on a particular area, not at the exclusion of others. I mean, I think you have to be careful. You never just say, okay, I'm only going to worry about them, or I'm only going to worry about them. I mean, we're a global force. We're a joint force. We operate, the United States has to operate across the spectrum of conflict and across the world. So, but it does give you a focus or a prioritization. And there's a lot to do. You know, I guess there was somebody said, what are you not going to do? Well, probably not sleep. I think Secretary Mattis kind of wears that on his shoulder. But there's a lot of concern out there. Some are near term. Some are longer term. But we want to, the strategy says, improve the lethality and readiness of the force. We want to create a more capable future force that will dominate the battlefield. We want to ensure that we have allies and friends, because we know that we're not going to have enough capacity to do this by ourselves. And then, obviously, there's changes in the processes of the building that need to be done, because it is a business, which leads to the resources. So, in 17, there was an appropriation after a CR. I think we've had CRs 8 of the 9 last years. It's not a really effective way to run a business. It's difficult. It restricts the things you can do. We have an appropriation for the rest of this year. It's a lot of money. And we are committed to spending that money as effectively and efficiently as we can. Even though there was an authorization bill for 19, there is not an appropriation yet. And our dealings with our Congress is, hey, look, it would really be great to have 18 months of budget stability. The number's important, but the stability is as important.
For predictability.
For predictability, for planning. I mean, I got a note today from Lou Caporata out of OneMef, and one of the things Secretary Mattis has asked us to do is, okay, if we get this money, we got to be able to show to the American people and the Congress and the United States government, I gave you this, what changed. I went from A to B. I went from C to D. My readiness went from here to here. And he gave me a whole list of things. Some things is, hey, the long lead time wait for a part was cut by 75%. We had this many engines that were not available, and it took this long to fix them. Now we've got this many on the shelf, and we're getting them fixed in this many days. So, you know, I don't want to discount the value of resources. Money isn't going to fix everything. But when you have a sustained, adequate resource stream, and you want to fix readiness, you want to create a modern force, and you want to create a future force, you can't do that unless you can plan and do business, not just within the government, within the commercial side, because we know all the R&D, not all, but a great majority of the R&D is done on the commercial side now, and they have to pay their employees, they have to, you know, support their subcontractors, because that's where we get our parts, and so that's really, really important. So the strategy kind of lays all that all out. And Secretary Mattis is having monthly meetings where we sit down and talk about where we are in the implementation of that strategy to make ourselves more ready, to make ourselves more lethal, to discuss where we are with the processes in the Pentagon. So I think, all in all, I think we had a lot of input to it. We're happy with it, and we're moving up.
I'll ask you in a moment some of your budget priorities specifically. But the challenge, I think, that... And, of course, being a service chief, he's also a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, so he's really at the center of all of the decision-making. But coming out of 14-plus years of war, where the Corps, alongside the Army, fought a very particular threat and a very particular means of war, but to lead the Corps into an era where a different kind of war fighting, the traditional expeditionary Marine Air Ground Task Force, is the need for the day. Can you talk to us a bit about what you've had to go through as the Commandant of the Marine Corps to move us from that environment of 14-plus years of a particular kind of warfare to preparing us for the future in that regard?
Well, first, we don't want to lose the capabilities that we've developed and the understanding. And so, you know, you train for the mission, you educate for the future. And you have to remember what you've done in the past. And we were tactically very successful in counterinsurgency. It was tough. But the adversary we fought was, although very determined and very willing to sacrifice themselves for their cause, they weren't very sophisticated. And so we had to have an idea. And so we had written a document called Expeditionary Force 21, and we revised it, and we named it the Marine Operational Concept. And the problem statement that it attempts to solve is the Marine Corps is currently not trained, organized, or equipped to fight a peer adversary in the year 2025. Mm. And so we then from that fall out a whole bunch of things, whether it be people, modernization, whether it be equipment, whether it be capabilities, whether it be simulation, whether it be all the different things that we needed to, how we're going to organize the force. And so we've been on a path to do that, to include the training that we do. So we still do some stability, but now we're doing more force on force. We're trying to replicate an adversary that is more of a peer, like you and I grew up with when we were facing the Soviet Union, and you and I could recite verbatim what vehicles were in the combat reconnaissance patrol and the distance between the advance guard and the main body and where this guy was, that guy. We have to get to that point against our potential adversaries, and that's happening. We have to be able to defend against an air threat. We haven't had an air threat. Even ISIS now is an air threat. So there's an entire process going on. We've changing the MEF headquarters group to the MEF information group because we see there's a need for electronic warfare, for cyber operations, for information operations. The information space has always been important, but now we want to give the MEF commander, our core level headquarters, the ability to do that. So what are our priorities? Resilient command and control across the joint force. What's dependable, because we're not assuming that the network's going to be there. And for you and I, the last 14 years, when we went to wherever we went, we kind of assumed that where the radio net was going to be there, we're going to have Zipper, we're going to have Merc Chat, that we're going to have streaming video, that we were going to have uninterrupted comms from a fixed site. That's not going to be the case. So resilient command and control, the ability to do information warfare, to include electronic warfare and cyber, long-range precision fires. We need a longer stick. both from air to ground, ground to ground, and from surface to air. And we need air defense. And when I say air defense, I mean ballistic missile defense, counter UAV, swarming UAV defense. How are we going to do that? How are we going to function? And then just protected maneuver. How are we going to maneuver, not just on the land, but in the air and on the sea? So those are our priorities as far as big categories of things that we're working on, and there's a bunch of subcategories of specific capabilities that fall out from there.
General, you've taken some real initiative within the service on issues associated with defending our own networks, et cetera, the cyber threat. Could you talk a bit about how the Marine Corps views that threat and the actions you've taken to defend the network?
Well, I think the whole Joint Force recognized several years ago with Cybercom that we were not investing in this capability, and we realized that what was going on in our networks, and we needed to harden our networks and make them more resilient. So there's a component, a service component to Cybercom, and they support different geographical or functional combatant commands. The Marine Corps, for a component to Cybercom, we support SOCOM.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a defense part, and there's another part, an offensive part. So we have to have cyber protection teams, and so you have to find people that have the skills, you have to, or the talent, and you got to train them. So, and they have to go through a very rigorous process, which has a high attrition, and then you've got to get them in the business, and then you got to keep them because they're smart, talented people, and the same types of things that we're looking for are being sought in the commercial side. I was at a town hall with the Marine Cyber Force out at Fort Meade, and a sergeant in the back stood up and goes, "Hey, General, how are you going to afford to keep me?" I said, "I have no idea." Because I know that Marine can walk down the street and command easily six figures plus. So what we've done is we've kind of decided that if you are a cyber Marine and you make it through all these wickets, we've got, they have their own MOS now.
Very good.
They're 17XX. And the deal I've made with them is, okay, you're never leaving.
That's sort of Foreign Legion approach, isn't it?
Well, because the one thing when I talk to these Marines, the thing, they love what they do. And it's not a good idea. It's like when you go to you go to SOCOM now. If you're a special operator, once you're in, that's what you do. You're good at it, and we're going to leave you alone and let you do your job. So I can't, you know, there's a pretty substantial bonus or proficiency pay for these folks. Still doesn't measure up as much as we could, the commercial side can offer, but I think the one thing I can offer them is, hey, you really like what you do. Okay, I'm going to let you do that. And I'm going to let you get really good. And then we're going to age that population, so they'll probably be, this is not, you know, a PFC, Lance Corporal business.
Mm-hmm.
So senior enlisted, chief warrant officer, limited duty officer, major lieutenant colonel business. So those Marines cost more money. And we're going to pay that, because we need to have that capability. So on the other services, I mean, we're looking at the Marine Reserve Force to create a cyber capability, because a lot of those Marines, that's what they do on their professional life. That's what they do in the business. So we're looking for them. So it's a big deal, because I think we realize that there's a fight going on right now as we speak. Everybody's network, and I've talked to some commercial companies, big network companies, they're running their own cyber network operations center.
That's right.
A lot of the people they hire come from us, and because that's what they want to do. And so we're in competition, but that's where we're going to go. I think at some point it'll be kind of like being a pilot. You'll come out of college and you want a cyber guarantee, and we'll give you a cyber guarantee.
Great.
And then if you make it through the school, then you'll get qualled, and that's what you'll go do. If you don't, then we'll
room in the grunt.
Make you an infantry officer.
Worked okay for you and
worked
me,
out
so.
For you. Of course, everyone knows that the most intelligent, handsome people on the earth are infantry officers.
as this would convey.
Exhibit A and B.
That's right. Before and after.
Before and
after. You choose. Commandant, your comments have been, I think, reinforced what all of us know about the Corps in any case, and that's the most important part of the Corps is the Marine. Can you talk to us a bit about how recruiting is going for the Corps today, and very importantly, how is the Corps doing on diversity?
Recruiting, we had a meeting today with some of the Marines that are members of Congress, and our commander of recruiting command was there, Major General Paul Kennedy.
Sure.
And we've already got all the people we need to recruit for this year. They're already in, they're already signed up, and they'll ship this summer. And by 1 October, we'll have over 50% of the people already signed up for next year.
That's terrific.
So 99.9% high school grads, highest mental, you know, percentage, 70% of the high to mental categories. So we're fortunate, and when that doesn't happen, when people just don't walk in the door, our recruiters are out there looking, talking to coaches, teachers, fellow Marines, anybody who can go out there and find a young man or woman who wants to serve their nation as a United States Marine. A lot of opportunity there, but most important, the ability to save for the rest of your life that you're a United States Marine. So we don't take that for granted. I'm in a similar place with officers. We probably got three or four young men or women for every spot we have to be a Marine officer.
Mm.
So that takes a lot of work. And we'll continue to drive on that. So as far as diversity, the number of women, when I assumed this office, I think the number of women in the Marine Corps, I said we were going to have a goal of about 10%, and we're about 9.2. In the last 4 years, for officer accessions, 23, 24, 25, and this year 32% of officers coming to the Marine Corps were men of color and ethnicity or women. So, with that, and the standard is the standard, where our quality is as high as it's ever been. So, are we where we want to be? We are predominantly a male. We are 91% men. And I'm not sure where, after 10%, we'll get to 10%, where we go after that. But I think if you look in every possible category of diversity, whether it be gender, whether it be ethnicity, anything else, I think we are a completely different Marine Corps than when we were 5, certainly 10 years ago. And so we know that the demographics of the nation are changing.
That's right.
The largest growing diversity category in the United States is Hispanic, which is also the largest growing category of Marines.
Terrific.
So we're continuing to go out there, but at the end of the it's about being a Marine. We're looking for people that want to be Marines, and those people that young men and women want to lead Marines. And at the end of the day, you look across, and there's a bunch of Marines out there.
For all the interns in here, we'll just take you get in the line as soon as we're done outside the door. If you're not inspired, so you've talked about the strategy. You've talked about a bit of the force. You've talked about your budget priorities. Talked about the people, where we are today. 10 to 15 years from now, how do you see the Corps?
Well, that's a tough one. You and I have had this conversation. We used to say that the nature of war is changing, but the character of war is still, one opponent trying to impose their will on the other, and I think that's true. But I think all the things that are going on now with automation and artificial intelligence, I don't know what war is going to look like.
Yeah.
And I think you're going to see a lot more of electronic, cyber affecting systems, and I think you're going to see a lot more use of machines. What's the role of a human being and the role of that machine? I think things that fly in the sky, the great majority of them are going to become, there will not be a human being at the controls in that device. There will be a human being somewhere maybe directing that thing. So it'll be very different. But in lower areas, what we would call low-intensity conflict or things of lower spectrum, you're still going to need somebody down there on the ground saying, this is mine, you can't have it, come get it. And that's going to be somebody, some soldier, sailor, airman, marine with a rifle or whatever we're carrying then, and be able to defend themselves. I mean, we are human beings. We're not carbon life forms. We're not androids. There's a human part of this. And so that's going to be the trick, is how do you leverage the technology that's there to reduce the risk to human life, but at the same time know that there are going to be groups or nation states or whomever out there who are going to contest, the national interests of your nation or threaten your citizens, and you have to be able to defend them. It would be nice if that wasn't the case, and we all hope that it all ends out well, but I'm not in that business. My business is to make sure that American lives and property are protected, and that the national interests of the United States are secured, and that we can have a peaceful, prosperous country and live in peace around the world.
We're glad you're in that business. Thank you. Just a quick question before we go to the audience. You don't have to answer this, but there's an awful lot of unemployed Marine generals that have gotten jobs recently in Washington. And we know that at some point, sadly for the country, you may leave active duty. Is there some department in this administration you've got your eye on right now, perhaps to... You don't have to answer that, General.
I'm going to Texas. I'm going to build me a house, and I'm going to ref high school football and work on my golf game.
And we know they'll be well recruited, and they'll be very capable. Okay, we've got about a half hour to go to the audience, and I'll ask if you would identify yourselves when you ask the question. And the question be relatively short, or I'll intervene, and we'll go from there. So, yes, sir, in the front row, or in the third row.
I'm very loud, and I'll wait for the mic anyway. Hi. Sir, General Sidney Friedberg from Breaking Defense. To pull on some of the modernization priorities you mentioned, the Army has its big six. They're putting out a very ambitious program of field testing and prototyping, a long-range precision fires missile, like you mentioned, upgrades to the current HIMARS rockets, a robotic ground combat vehicle, optionally manned vehicles, optionally manned aircraft. I know the Corps is working with the Army and at least observing a lot of those things, but, are those potentially systems you might end up buying, or are you still in a wait-and-see mode, or are you thinking probably not?
Well, you're correct. We're kind of the smallest child at the dinner table within the Department of Defense.
But the meanest.
And but we're pretty scrappy. So we have a lot of things, capabilities that we're looking at that are similar to the capability sets the Army is looking at. And so we're following a lot of those things. And what we'll do is we'll follow them. Whether it be long-range precision munitions or armored vehicles. And we have a board where we meet monthly at general officer level, and we talk about those things. And we want to get the most scaled, cost-effective program that we can. And so we're very transparent with what we're doing and what they're doing. And so right now, we're watching, we're following. They're making a lot of progress in certain areas, and then as those things mature, we'll invest in them as long as they can meet our requirement. And we do the same thing with our shipmates in the Navy and with the Air Force. So, we're part of the Department of the Navy. We're a separate service. I don't even remind everybody that. There's four services. And three departments. And so we work together, and I think all four of the service chiefs, the places that General Allen was talking about, we've all been there together, so we all know each other, and we're all trying to work the same effect, make sure that we get the most capable, lethal, ready force we can with the best effective use of the resources that are available. So this money is here. We're going to take advantage of it, and because we're not sure what's going to happen in the future. But to answer your question, we're following and tracking all these things.
Good question. Thank you. Yes, sir. Third row on the flank.
Good morning, General. Otto Kreischer with Sea Power Magazine. You talked about your recruiting, how well you're doing in recruiting, but you also mentioned earlier your need to build up your cyber and information warfare guys. Are you getting the kind of people you need to fill those billets, have your recruiters changed their targeting to find those kind of people you need? The latest budget doesn't increase the Corps, so you're going to have to work within the numbers you have. So you're going to reshape the manpower in your Corps, but are you going to get the skilled, talented people you need to do information warfare and cyber?
I think that we're going to find out. We've had a very effective program over many, many years that goes back to even in prior to Vietnam, where we had people involved in what we call our radio battalions.
Right.
And they did electronic warfare, and theirs were very skilled, capable Marines. And we've drawn from a number of them to go into this cyber business. And so, and we've also, like, if you want to try out for Green Berets or NAVSPEC War or MARSOC, it doesn't matter what your MOS is. So we're out there recruiting for any Marine, and we have a kind of a assessment test that we give them, and then we bring them in and see how they do. But Marines are primarily that are in the communications field. They get into cyber defense. They get in a certain MOS of cyber protection, and then we figure out who can move on into the other things. So the officer thing is going to be different, and thus far we've made our timeline to build these teams. It's not going to happen quickly, which is why it's important that we keep them, and we're going to have to pay for that. You know, one of the reasons people say, why didn't you increase your end strength, even though you may have got more money for manpower? So, well, because the Marines we want to keep are not Lance Corporals. They're going to cost more money. So that's why this year, you know, the growth in Marine Corps you're going to see is 100. Because the ones that we want inside the 186, they're going to cost more money. So the general, I said, what's the Marine Corps going to like? Marine Corps is going to get older.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to get older. Not a lot older. I mean, we're far and away the youngest service. 62% of the Marine Corps is 25 years old or less. Welcome to my morning brief.
And, what could go wrong with that?
But, well, and to their credit, you know, 99.x% of them are out there doing exactly what you expect to be doing. But on occasion, I'm sure all of us were perfect when we were 18 to 25 years old. But that's something we have to keep a constant eye on. But I do think it's going to become more senior, and I think as more and more people go to the university and they go into this type of field, whether it's computer programming or mathematics, or they just have a propensity for this. I'm not one of those people that, you know, we go out there and say, you could come in the Marine Corps and do this. And what do you think?
In the back, please, on the left-hand side. Again, please identify yourselves.
Oh, sure. Thank you. I'm Jim Hasek. I'm a professor at the National Defense University. I noted a moment ago, sir, you said, yes, we have four military services. I was myself once in the Navy. And I drove you all around, amphibious fleet. So I very much appreciate the Marine Corps. But three military departments. There's been some discussion in this town of late that maybe we could have three military departments, but five military services. I'm speaking about the Space Corps business. As a service chief, what advice might you have to, I'm just postulating here, a future commandant of the Space Corps about running the smaller of two military services within an already established military department.
I think within the Department of the Navy, the Secretary of the Navy, you know, is de facto the Secretary of the Marine Corps. So we have a separate budget line, and, you know, there is always tension between when we're building ships, how many ships, because obviously one of our readiness issues is we need to have more amphib ships, and not just more amphib ships, but we need to have more capable amphib ships. So I think if you were to take any department and subdivide it, you know, you have to be sure that there's a separate funding line and that you understand how the training. There's a lot of overhead to that. I mean, you run your own entry-level training. I mean, are you going to do that or not? Or what are you going to do for schools? And so I think that's the concern I think most people have when you're going to create another service in addition to the bureaucracy and the number of generals or admirals or whatever it is. You know, what are you going to do for entry-level training and where is the schooling going on? General Goldfein, you know, is the Chief of Staff of the Air Force and the Secretary of the Air Force. I mean, they are working through. They've got space capabilities. They all come operationally under General Hyten at Stratcom. You know, we're consumers and users of space. We probably got a few Marines assigned to Strat. I know we have a few Marines assigned to Strat and to the people that do the space business. More and more, I think people are concerned about space. You know, 20 years ago, if you told me I was going to be interested in what's going on in space, I would have asked you why would I possibly be interested in that. Today, I'm fascinated. And because a lot of things that we do are dependent upon that. So as far as advice to somebody, you know, you just got to make sure you got your own funding and budget line and that the service secretary is going to be there to adjudicate any issues. I'm not advocating on one way or the other. That'll be decided by the Secretary of Defense and probably with some discussion with the Congress of the United States. But space is a critical area. And as long as we're functioning effectively there, which I believe we are today, I'm good to go.
Yes, sir, in the back.
William Dean, Bridge Institution. So the budgeteers are posting charts that show trillion-dollar deficits projected now into the indefinite future. So, you know, from now until, say, 2030, 2040. The problem is that when the financial markets anticipate those future budgets and the impact on our economy, they tend to make trades and decisions now that bring that future to the present in the form of financial crises. My question for you, sir, is are there folks in the Marine staff that do budget trades for really significant, deep budget cuts that would have to take place immediately, say 30 to 50% immediate across-the-board cuts, and how the Marine Corps would position itself to be able to survive that scale or magnitude of a cut.
Identify yourself, please. Who are you?
Yes, William Dean.
Associated with?
I started my own think tank. That's
okay. Good. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, sir.
You know, you're always worst case in it. I mean, we did not believe a couple of years ago. You know, we were looking at the force was going to get smaller, and so we had built a whole number of force models. I mean, we are the biggest single fiscal obligation we have is people. So the fastest way, if you had to take a big cut, would be to cut people and or structure. And then the question is, do you make the units you have smaller? And we keep the number of units, hoping you're going to be able to grow them back, or do you cut whole units or whole capabilities? Hey, we don't really need to do this. We could do this. Have we done a budget drill to address the magnitude of a cut that you described? No. Are there people that work for us that have models and things, and then have we considered having to do that? We did a couple of years ago. We never throw that stuff away because who knows what? You know, I think all of us. You know, this is a lot of money. $700 billion is a lot of money. I don't do policy. I don't do fiscal policy. I establish requirements, and I try to articulate risk. And so this budget that we have for this year and hopefully for next year I am beyond that. We could be back to budget control BCA levels because that's what the law is. And so are we looking at what's going to happen when that happens? Yes. Nobody expects this to go on. I don't expect it to go on indefinitely. And we clearly have sat down as uniformed military members and then the civilian leadership of the department and looked at, we know what the trend lines are as far as deficits and all that. We don't have our head in the sand.
Other questions? Yes, sir, please, in the middle. On the left.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for being here. My name is David Hutchins. I'm here on behalf of the Turkish Heritage Organization. As a Marine myself, it's an honor to have you both here. Hoorah. I'm a grunt myself. I served from 2009 to 2015.
Another handsome man.
I was just thinking that.
So my question is grunt-related. Where do you see the future of the U.S. Marine Corps infantry going in the next 10 years? How's it going to change? Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, I think it's changing right now. I think, if you believe that there's always going to be a requirement for some sort of ground maneuver force that has to close with and control battle space or control terrain and or populations or provide security for others to do other things. I think the lethality and the range of the infantry is going to get much, much longer. I think the accuracy of the weapons because of autonomy and different things is going to get much, much greater. I think the protection of the individual soldier or Marine or special operator is going to go up because of changes in technology. I think communications, the battlefield awareness of that individual unit. I'm going to give you an example. So when General Allen and I were company commanders, back when there were still horse-drawn artillery.
Right after the Civil War.
I was the company commander, and I had eight radios. I had eight radios. And then if we were out on a battalion operation, I got another radio that had encryption. The rest of them were unencrypted. And when we stopped at night, we ran wire to telephones that ran on D-cell batteries, and that's how we talked, which was actually pretty good because your signature was really, really low, and you got off the radio because we were afraid the Soviets were going to find us and shoot artillery at us. And the only people that had a radio on were those on patrol. And they usually turned it off until they got to a checkpoint, and then they called in, or they had a problem. Now everybody's got a radio. Now they got a tablet. Now a rifle squad in the Marine Corps has their own UAV. They got a guy in the squad flying a quadcopter. He's going to see over the other side of the hill. I'm not going to have to say, hey, go see what's on the other side of the hill. Just no. Go fly that. Put it in the air. Go see what's on the other side of the hill. I mean, the gear's better, it's lighter, it's more durable, the people are fitter, but the information flow that's available to the squad leader, the platoon commander, company commander is to the point I have some concerns about it. You can have too much information. So we're making some organizational changes to look at that. We've used autonomous vehicles. Right now I can give you a vehicle to carry a lot of your heavy stuff that just kind of follows you like a pack mule. And you don't have to, you just got to make sure it's got gas. It doesn't need, you don't have to find forage for it. Although animals do work. So I think at some point, I remember DepSecDef, Mr. Work used to saying, the day is here, if not, is coming, if not here, where when you and I enter a room to clear a room, the first thing in the room is not a human being, but a robot. Because I don't want you to be the first, I don't want a human being to be the first one in the room. So now we get into autonomy, we get into robotics, and now how do I move this stuff? How do I carry it? If I'm going to terrain, I mean, it works great in a building or on a flat surface, but the one advantage of being a human being and being in the infantry is, you know, ain't no mountain high enough, ain't no valley low enough, ain't no river wide enough to keep me from getting to you. And because I got my feet, now I can go exoskeletal, you know, I can get lighter weight. I mean, I'm amphibious because I swim. So, I mean, human being still is the preeminent force on the battlefield for at least the near future.
Yes, sir. And we'll come to the lady in the second row in a moment.
Michael Spiro, University of Pittsburgh. How has strategy formulation changed in the Marine Corps between the previous administration and the current administration?
Thank you.
You know, the previous strategy was based on the quadrennial defense review that came up with the 4+1 construct. People's Republic of China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, and then violent extremists. It actually, I think, as I recall, it made the VEO threat was the main effort. And the others were mentioned, but not as clearly articulated as what capabilities they had. So this administration and this Department of Defense, I'm not being critical of the strategy, but many of the things are the same. I think the thing about this strategy, in my mind, for the Marine Corps, it very clearly says, okay, I want you to focus on this. And then it also talks about all the competition, the renewal of competition of great powers, and the idea and the acceptance that in many areas of modernization and future capabilities, the United States has got to get themselves back in the game. There are certain capabilities where we believe we have an edge, a competitive edge that we want to retain. And there are other areas where it may be even, and there's other areas where we think we're no longer the peer. And so it lays some of those out. And then that's where we're going to focus our investment. So I think that's the difference between the two.
Yes, ma'am. You had a question in the second row.
Thank you so much. Thanks for taking my question. I'm Marina Fazel, an African-American journalist. Thank you for your service. I can see that being a soldier and being a general, obviously, has you focused on the threat, and everything that has been said here has been focused on developing more lethal and long-term weaponry for the future. But at the same time, it's fascinating to listen to you speak as a human being, describe the values of being a human being. Just a minute ago, you spoke about our capacity to be amphibian and change and still be ahead of machinery. And yet here we are in the digital era where we are facing entirely new threats. On a layman level, as a strategist, what is your advice for future leaders? I know that you've always been focused on developing the most lethal systems to protect, but isn't the way forward for human beings, for the species, something other than war? Thank you.
Well, I would hope so. I would hope that, you know, I mean, look at your country. I mean, you would think at some point, not just in Afghanistan, but I mean, we get tired of this. There's other things to do. So, but I don't deal in aspirations. I deal in reality. And, you know, we're, unlike General Allen, I've never served in Afghanistan. I visited there many times, so I don't feel myself qualified. Until you live in a place and really see the people and find out what's going on, I don't think you can really say you understand. You can try to understand. But at some point, you ask yourself in this, how does this end? Or is this just the normal way things are? It would be nice. I think we all have aspirations that it, you know, that there is a better way to do this. But in the meantime, I mean, there are groups of people out there, ISIS, Al Qaeda. I'm not so sure there's a way to negotiate with them. I don't think that we're going to convince them that we're right and they're wrong. They're certainly not going to convince us that they're right and we're wrong. And so there's going to be conflict. And we have to deal with that. And so just like President Macron yesterday in front of the U.S. Congress talked about, I believe that freedom-loving, democratic people are willing to stand up and sacrifice for what they think is important. And that's what I get paid to do.
Let me just add to that because I think it's really important. The general, of course, lives those values. And in societies like ours, the United States, and similar societies, in my own experience in the last several years in dealing with the precious young soldiers and sailors and airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, has been that while the outcome of their profession may be the taking of life, that's not why they went in the service. And in fact, most of them, I would say, have come into the service prepared to give their lives for higher principle than that they came into the service to take life. And I think there's a profound difference between the two. And that is certainly at the heart of our U.S. services, and I can't speak for the other nations that may be in here. I've served with at least 49 other nations' services, and I've always felt very comfortable. But who we are as a people and what we are as a military force is much more about our preparation to sacrifice on behalf of greater principles than necessarily being organized, trained, and equipped simply to go out and take life, which I think was an important point that he made. It's about protecting Americans and American property and that of our allies, not solely organized to go out and take life. And I think that's an important
I can remember in Iraq in 2006 when I was at General Allen Refugee. So I was meeting with some local sheikhs, and I was like, hey, what do you want? He says, we want new roads. I said, I want new roads. He says, we want electricity. I said, I want electricity. We want hospitals and schools. I said, I want hospitals and schools. We want you to leave. I said, we agree on everything. Why are you fighting me?
Aren't we glad he's the 37th Commandant? Yes, sir.
I think you can hear me. Robbie Harris, a former naval person. I'm here in challenge. I want to follow up on 2 points. I think I heard you say that in 15 years there may not be any manned aircraft. Point number one. And I think I heard you say that the budget largesse that we have this year and next year won't last. Did I hear those 2 points correctly?
Yes. So and maybe to clarify the first one, there's no reason. I mean, we can fly darn near everything we got now without having a human being in the cockpit. I mean, in Vietnam, we could fly remember the old ASRAT? We could fly A-4s around there, and there was somebody in there, but the guy on the ground could dial you around and take you where you wanted to go. I mean, the capability is much more sophisticated. I mean, any vehicle we have, any airplane we have, almost could be flown. Now, whether it could be function and the weapon systems and all that, but to fly that thing, I'm not sure we need a human being. Now, the budget, to the point made in the back, I mean, that's a lot of money. And the fiscal health of a nation is part of their national security. So I never assume anything. I mean, in the military, you plan for the worst and you hope for something better. That way you're never disappointed. Right? I'm a Marine. I expect nothing and I get less. Okay? That way I'm always happy. It's always can get better. But I think that it's a lot of money. And we understand that. And that's why if there is an appropriation for 19, based on what the authorization bill is, I mean, we are working to make that as much benefit out of that money as we possibly can, and account for every single dollar we spend and wring every bit of readiness, lethality, and modernization and future capability out as we can. Absolutely. And, you know, and the Secretary of Defense has been absolutely crystal clear on that. And I do not want to be standing in front of his desk on the 1st of October explaining why we didn't spend all our money.
Hmm.
I will not be standing in front of his desk on one, because I'm going to say, yeah, we spent it all, and here's what we did, and we went from A to B.
Before you wrap up, I'd like to ask, as a matter of protocol, once you do wrap up, and we thank the Commandant, we should all please stay in our seats as he departs.
Very good. Thank you, Mike. We have a couple questions left. Let's go to both questions very quickly because we have about 3 minutes. The lady against the back wall, please, and then the gentleman right in front of her.
Thank you. I wouldn't have spoken had Ms. Fuzzle not made her statement earlier. I am a cross-border Pashtun from Afghanistan, Pakistan. My family was divided by the Durand Line, and I had served with the Marine Corps in Iraq and Afghanistan, specifically in the countering insurgencies. The thing, sir, is you mentioned ISIS and Al-Qaeda. They were born among civilians, which is why under General Nicholson, I helped to start the female engagement teams. Please remember, women are not bombing us. Women are not shooting at us for the most part. We need to start reaching out, and I used to emphasize this to the Marines. Apart from knowing how to shoot a gun, they should know how to talk to people wherever they happen to be, and they will win so much more. Thank you.
Yes, sir, please. I think we have one final question over here. This will be the last one.
Steve Winters, independent consultant. General, you mentioned Robert Work. And do you get the sense that the change in focus from the 4+1, which you mentioned with the Quad report, to the current sort of big two in the NDS, is being driven by an increasing appreciation of the technological challenges posed by the big two? I was struck recently when Mr. Griffin over at the Defense Department said something, we're not going to be focusing on the Mideast. That's not our priority right now. That might have come across as a very shocking statement, but from the standpoint of the technological challenge, it's sort of an obvious necessity.
No, I think that's a fair statement, although, you know, we may, you know, it's as much as we might like to divert attention from the Mideast, they continue to be fascinated with us. And as long as there's risk to our friends and allies there, and we don't want to play a home game. But I do believe that the two and the 2+3, because of their large investment and continued development in all these future technologies, that's driving a lot of the stuff as far as investments and things that we're doing. And so, and they both are, you know, they are peer competitors, potentially, if they choose. And we all have choices. So I just respond to her comment. I agree with you. I mean, but for the same reason that the Marine Corps developed female engagement teams, for the same reason that the Marine Corps put advisors and enhanced the number of advisors with Iraqi and Afghan forces, for the same reason that we drove miles and miles and miles and went to all sorts of shuras and town halls and had KLEs and met with sheikhs and leaders and mukhtars and business people, for the very reason you said, to talk to people. Talk to people. So I agree with you. I'm not sure that, you know, I got the sense that you didn't think that we were willing to do that. I assure you, at least my experience has been that was really, and General Allen, maybe in his own time, maybe the best example of that, him and a guy named Dave Reist spent hours drinking tea, trying to convince people that, yeah, we all want the same thing. Why can't we just figure out, you know,
know, kind of the Rodney King philosophy of life. Can't we just all get along? I'm not being facetious.
Final question here. We're slightly over, so.
My name is Jim Connors. Thank you both for your service. General, can you tell us what your wristband is for?
Oh, this? So it was April 2006, and we had just gotten there, and we were beginning to field a electronic jammer to defeat remotely controlled IEDs that we were pretty confident was going to work really, really well. So then we realized, okay, so what's left? If they can't use a remote control, a phone, or a garage door opener or something, what are they? Well, they got two choices. They can either put it in the middle of the road and put some sort of a pressure device and you got to drive over it, or they're going to have to sit there and wait for you to drive by and then touch the batteries together. So, okay, so I can handle that. So I'm going to drive if they want to do that. And the TTP had been to drive really fast because to try to beat the guy pushing the button. So we had to retrain everybody. It's like, look, you got to go slow. Because slow, because you got to see what the ground looks like. And slow, because if there's a guy out there, a guy, not a woman, a guy out there trying to blow you up, you want him to think that you can see him. And at least then we have a fight. So we started to think about it. I said, well, yeah, what if we just push something, put something on in front of the truck? Let's push something in front of the truck, like a roller or a farm tool. And then we could do that. And so I started researching. It's not a new idea. And I mean, there were people that had done it. And so I posed this. We had a working group with the EOD guys. And the explosive ordnance disposal people, they're all kind of old, crusty, limited duty officers. And they're like, oh, you know, General, it's not a good idea, you know, to blow up. And they can offset the charge. The gunner's going to get fragged. You know, what if it doesn't work? And I went, oh, yeah, you know, maybe you're right. And so I went, it was April 22nd, and I went in and I got all the casualty reports on my computer. And this young man named Eric Leakin in 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines up near Haditha, he came across as KIA. And he was driving a Humvee, and he ran over a pressure IED, and he was basically consumed by the blast. And I read that, and I started thinking about my idea. And then I got angry with myself because I was doubting myself, you know. And I was like, you're a general, right? You're supposed to make decisions. You're supposed to force people to do what you think is right. You're supposed to keep these guys alive. So we had a meeting the next day. I walked in. I go, okay, we're going to build rollers. And all the, I said, no, I'm not asking your opinion anymore. So we did. And in a matter of months, we had a roller fabricated, and then industry found out about it. And now you see all these things on the front of all these trucks. I mean, there was stuff already out there. We just weren't using it. And so that was kind of my, so I finally, it took me 10 years to buy this bracelet. I was at a PX, and they were having, you know, memorial bracelets. And I had a picture of the kid in my car. And then I got a bracelet, and it was kind of my, like, this is my, you're a general, do your job bracelet. And then the battalion commander, Brigadier General Norm Cooling, this kid was in 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines, he said, hey, let me take a picture of you for the battalion newsletter, because we're having a reunion. So I took a picture like this, and then I got a text from a guy and goes, hey, my name is John Smith. Jake Leakin wants to know why you're wearing his son's name on your wrist. He wants to talk to you. So aren't you glad you asked me this question? Anyway, so I called the guy and I go, you know, they live in Du Bois, Indiana, southern Indiana, in a very rural area. And he goes, hey, so I told him the story I just told you. And he goes, well, Jake wants to talk to you. So I'm like, oh, I don't really want to talk to his dad. I don't do well at memorial services. Don't ever ask me to do your eulogy because it'll be all sloppy and nasty. So some people are really good at that. I'm not. So finally, after about 2 weeks, I said, all right, I got to call the guy. So I called him up. Very nice man. We had a nice chat. And eventually I've flown out and I've met him. I've been to his grave. Went back out to Crane, Indiana, Naval Weapons Station, Crane, Indiana. The Leakins came there. They had everybody from their county there, and we had a big hoo-yah and took pictures. And they named a building at Crane after him. So that's the story. That's who I wear.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we are honored to have the 37th Commandant of the Marine Corps with us today. He's obviously a great strategic thinker and a visionary. My first combat patrol in Iraq was dawn of the September 11th, 2006, and you led that patrol, if you recall. And I'd just come in on my advance party, and from that moment to this, it was clear to me that you were going to be one of the great leaders of the Corps. And, Bob, I can't thank you enough for sharing this with us today, for all of your great service to the nation, and certainly for your leadership to the Corps and to the Joint Force today. Thank you very much.
How about that? Yeah, that. Do you think most people listen to that? No, that's kind of shit get buried. That's why you listen to All Marine Radio. And let me just tell you something. F-18 man, who's been in River City for a while, he just emerged from River City, because I've been thinking, like, all right, where is... Now, I got to... See, if you haven't noticed, I supervise all these chuckleheads, okay? And Gunner's going to join us here. Speaking of chuckleheads, his name popped into my head. That kind of stuff is awesome. Let me tell you, the whole thing is awesome. The last story that Neller just told about why somebody smart enough to ask him about those bracelets, because those are pretty powerful stories if you ask anybody. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. He tells that story, you know, it's a reminder to him to do his job, to people bet their lives on his ability to do his job. And pretty cool stuff. Pretty cool stuff. Why the Marine Corps never gets out of your system. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Gunner joins us next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.